Spain sees its borrowing costs soar.
And that's revived worries about the European debt situation.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith in New York. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Thursday, April 5th.
Coming up, Greece's Olympians are in jeopardy.
And Detroit wrestles a monster budget deficit.
It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
If you thought the Eurozone crisis had gone away, think again. Spain had been trying to borrow money on the financial markets, but it's raised less than it hoped, and it's paying a higher interest rate.
That is likely to set alarm bells ringing within Europe's corridors of power. If Spain's borrowing costs rise too much, it may find itself unable to meet its debts and need huge rescue loans, additional ones. The BBC's Tom Burridge joins us from Spain with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So borrowing costs have now reached the highest level in Spain since December. What's going on?
Well, I mean, essentially, we had a general strike in Spain last week. Then we had this new budget from the government, 27 billion euros worth of savings, 17% cuts across government department budgets, and huge tax increases. Things like income tax are going up, at the cost of gas, electricity. This was essentially the government's plea to the markets to say, actually, we're going to get our budget deficit in order. And they were hoping, I guess, this week that these bond auctions would go more favorably than they did.
Are the Spanish willing to do what it sounds like the international lenders want them to do to get their debt under control or not?
Talk to most people on the streets and the answer is no. I think essentially most Spanish people want less austerity from the government. They want a hands-off approach to things like health, education, their public systems here in Spain. But the government is committed to this program of austerity. Although you've got people like Mario Draghi, he's the president of the European Central Bank, coming out since these bond auctions saying actually what the markets are asking is for more from Spain. And a lot of economists feeling that if you look at the projections of the Spanish economy this year, that it's expected to contract by 1% to 2%. Now, it could be worse than that. And if it is worse than that, if the economy contracts more than is expected this year, then it won't hit that target, it won't reassure the markets, and it won't do what it's aiming to do.
Tom, one-word answer here. Is Spain's debt crisis getting better or worse?
It's getting worse at the moment.
The BBC's Tom Burridge in Madrid. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, let's get some domestic reaction now from Diane Swank, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. She's with us from Chicago, as always. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Well, I read in the Wall Street Journal this morning that an analyst in Europe said the medicine is wearing off in Europe. Do you agree with that?
Well, what we've seen is the Central Bank of Europe, the European Central Bank, has bought the region some time to cure some of the problems that ail it. And unfortunately, the Europeans haven't used that time as wisely as the Central Bank would have liked.
What do you mean? What should the Europeans have done with that time?
Well, the clear issue in Spain is they had to go back and make deep cuts again. They're facing their second recession because of austerity moves in 3 years. But more fundamentally is at the core of Europe. France has done nothing and is moving in the other direction. One of the largest economies in Europe, away from deficit reduction, away from dealing with their debt problems, and sort of in denial and trying to enact policies that are more reminiscent of the early and socialist 1980s than policies that would be applicable today.
And I saw that French borrowing costs went up yesterday, too. You were just in France since last we talked last week. Do people there have the same view that you do, that things really need to be done, or do they not feel that way?
Well, certainly economists do, although my economist friends were quick to point out and hand me literally the Economist magazine that has an article saying France in denial. Hmm. And the politicians, they have an election April 16th. Both Sarkozy and Holland, who are running against each other, are making promises of additional spending and thinking of things as high as 75% tax rates. Boy, that would send shivers down the spine of anyone in the United States and certainly not cure the problems that ail France. It's hard to think of anyone working at those kind of tax rates.
Well, what's the U.S. risk of all this at this point?
Well, our risk is more minimized than it once was because, of course, our banks are in better shape. Tim Geithner made a point of that yesterday. We recapitalized our banks, and so we don't have the same risk in our banking system that we did in 2008, but we are exposed still somewhat through money market funds. That was a major problem in 2008, and let's face it, when a country as big as France stumbles, we know the ripple effects are felt to the rest of the world, and there's a lot of landmines still out there in this war we're fighting.
Diane Swong, Chief Economist with Mesirow Financial, thanks as always.
Thank you.
357,000 people applied for unemployment benefits last week. That's the lowest number in nearly 4 years, and bodes well for the monthly unemployment numbers out tomorrow. But all regions are not created equal when it comes to jobs. We go now to our weekly attitude check, a partnership with Gallup.
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. He joins us now. Good morning, Frank.
Hello.
So we've been hearing a lot about the slowly recovering economy and job market, but what are some of the regional differences in terms of cities and places where the job market is the best and the worst in the country?
Boy, there are some differences. Oklahoma City is the place to be.
Not only does the wind come sweeping down the plains, you can get a job.
Absolutely. It had the most positive job creation index of any place that we've looked at over the last year. Now, this is not always related to unemployment, because unemployment, you know, has denominators based on how many people are looking for work. But it so happens in Oklahoma City, the unemployment rate last time I looked at it is 5.9%. So, indeed, that's kind of a verification. It's a great place to be. The other in the top five are Pittsburgh, Richmond, Virginia, Nashville, and Orlando.
Do we have an idea of why the job situation looks so good there?
You know, it's very varied. We looked around to try to see if there was some commonality. Now, in the top 10, we do have Houston and San Antonio, and one of the top 10 cities, although California is pretty bad in general, is Silicon Valley, San Jose, Sunnyvale, Santa Clara, California. Now, that's obvious. Things booming out there. But otherwise, it seems to be a variety of different kinds of industries that are fueling the positive job creation, because Pittsburgh has, you know, a different situation than Oklahoma City, and that, in turn, is quite a bit different than Orlando. But on the other hand, you know what's at the very bottom? Absolute worst place to be, at least based on ours, is Providence, Rhode Island.
Really?
The working residents of Providence were most likely to tell us that their companies where they worked were letting people go and not hiring. And then, speaking about old kind of eastern cities, Buffalo is also in the bottom five.
Well, what about confidence? How much does that relate with jobs? Are some places more confident than others?
Oh, absolutely. We calculate our consumer confidence index. We call it economic confidence. Same thing we look by cities. And it's not always correlated. In fact, guess what area had the most ebulliently positive residents about the economy of any other was our nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
Well, that's kind of nice that there's so much optimism in D.C.
Well, I guess if you're a hardcore conservative, you wouldn't say that was nice, because they may be confident because they know there are a lot of federal jobs there, although they're trying to cut it back. So I guess it depends on how you look at it. But those residents are very positive. Also, people in Memphis and Salt Lake City and back down in Texas and Austin, Texas, and again, Richmond. And the place you don't want to be if you want to be around optimists is Buffalo, New York, the least economically confident city in the major metropolitan areas of anyone that we looked at.
Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief of Gallup. Frank, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, let's get back to those jobs numbers Stacy was talking about a moment ago. We got an early word on tomorrow's employment report this morning from a job placement firm called Challenger, Gray, and Christmas. It reported that the number of planned layoffs dropped last month to a 10-month low. John Challenger is CEO, and he's with us now from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, what do your numbers tell you about the job market and what we can expect tomorrow?
These are positive numbers, 10-month low. Just over 37,000 and down 27% from February, down 9% from March a year ago. So a real signal that the economy right now, from a labor standpoint, is in good shape.
Now, last time we talked a month ago, you said that that you were seeing some higher numbers of planned layoffs, but that combined with good job growth meant that we were in a dynamic job market. Now that your number of planned layoffs is falling, what does that mean?
Well, still suggest, I think, we're in a period where companies have set the stage. They're not laying many people off for the kind of hiring that will really continue to drive unemployment down. Unless we see some shock to the economy, maybe these high oil prices, we should see strong hiring in the months to come.
And, John, where are you seeing layoffs? What sectors are we talking about?
Well, in the month of March, heaviest layoffs were in telecom, particularly call centers. A number of companies, from Verizon to Wells Fargo, QVC, all cut jobs, T-Mobile as well, in call centers. But otherwise, it was really quite spread out between consumer products, transportation, and other sectors.
John Challenger, CEO of Challenger Grand Christmas, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Today, President Obama is scheduled to sign the Jobs Act. That's the Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act. The legislation is being billed as a way to ease regulation on small businesses and help them attract investors so they can create more jobs. But critics complain it erases too many hard-fought financial regulations. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has that story.
After the dot-com bust, Wall Street had to play by new rules. A firewall was set up between stock analysts and investment bankers in the same firm. So when the bankers met with a company going public, they couldn't say, "Hire us, and our analysts will say good things about you." Now, for some companies, that's changing. Jay Ritter teaches finance at the University of Florida.
This could result in more pressure on the analyst to promise that I'll put out a buy recommendation when the company goes public.
Other companies will no longer have to file quarterly reports with details like how much money they made or lost. Jack Coffey teaches law at Columbia University.
And I think that is probably the largest retreat from transparency since the original passage of the securities laws back in the 1930s.
The Jobs Act also rolls back parts of the new Dodd-Frank financial reform bill. Now, some companies won't have to disclose executive compensation or let shareholders vote on it. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Well, those are some of the potential downsides of the bill President Obama is expected to sign today. But some businesses are thinking it's a great thing. And here's Alex Goldmark with that story.
Crowdfunding websites got their start as a way for lots of little donors to finance bigger arts projects. But more businesses are getting in on the game. Justin Jensen asked for cash for his product that didn't even exist yet.
My product is CineSkate, and it's a set of three wheels that attach onto a tripod.
That rolling tripod makes videos smoother, so he needed money to go from invention to production.
It turns out that we met that $20,000 goal in about one day, the first day.
By the end, he got almost $500,000 from 2,000 donors, and all he offered in return was his product as a thank you gift. He wasn't allowed to sell stock. Now he is. Jensen used the crowdfunding website called Kickstarter. There are about a dozen of these, and they stand to gain a lot now that the Jobs Act lets the sites play middleman between online investors and small startups.
We have to register with the SEC now. We have to register with a self-regulatory organization. The professionalization of our industry is already underway.
Freeman White recently launched his site, called Launched, with a T at the end, because the law looked likely to change. So he studied it closely. There will be background checks and document filings and, yes, legal liability for the websites.
It's a game changer for sure.
Slava Rubin heads Indiegogo, one of the elder crowdfunding sites at 4 years old. That head start gives him a leg up on recruiting the coming wave of new business.
So will it change things? Absolutely. There'll be a lot of experimentation in the early days, and then people will really figure it out.
That's when we'll find out if these social media sites can really let you and me try our hand as venture capitalists. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace.
Well, Stacey, the UK government has a little favor to ask of British tourists traveling abroad.
Oh.
Stop
that?
Calling us asking for restaurant recommendations and directions. And to complain that there are ants in your vacation house. These are all things that actually happened. These calls actually came into embassies. And so did this one. This is my favorite. A British visitor to Rome called to ask if the consulate staff would go throw a coin in a fountain for him because he forgot to do so while he was on vacation.
I guess it's like a can you be a wish middleman or something? I guess.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
The city of Detroit has projected a deficit of more than $200 million this year, and it could run out of money by June. Last night, Detroit's city council narrowly passed a controversial deal with the state of Michigan. Marketplace's David Gura has that.
In addition to Detroit's deficit, the city's on the hook for billions, money it's promised current and former workers in retirement and health benefits. The plan approved yesterday calls for more oversight from outside the city, including the state government. City Council President Charles Pugh says this plan is an important first step.
We are at a critical point where, you know, our revenues are so low and some of our costs are fixed or growing. So that's a problem, we've got to make adjustments still.
At a special session last night, council members got an earful from city residents, including Malik Shabazz.
Any mayor and any council persons that would willingly sign away our hard-fought power, rights, and gains is either too stupid, too ignorant, or too traitorous for the people to allow.
The plan's backers said they didn't have much of a choice. The state threatened to appoint an emergency manager if the council couldn't agree to a plan by today. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The Masters Golf Tournament starts today, and Tiger Woods is back after his first PGA win in 2 years. As Sally Herships reports, TV executives are counting on Tiger to pump up the ratings.
Tiger Woods, what's a golf fan supposed to do with you? Look away or watch?
This obviously excites just about everyone.
Neil Pilson is past president of CBS Sports, which airs the Masters.
Excites his fans, the casual viewers that follow Tiger, and of course the television network executives at CBS.
Pilson says when Woods is playing, the ratings shoot up 30-40%. On top of that, at Augusta, Tiger Woods will have to take on a younger version of himself, Rory McIlroy. For advertisers, it's a hole in one.
Anytime you can create a matchup where people are curious, that's good for ratings, it's good for spending, it's good for the advertising community.
Ed Horn works for marketing for Madison Avenue Sports. He says the audience that watches golf is older and wealthy, but Tiger Woods attracts younger viewers too. Another win for advertisers. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
And speaking of sports, today the Greek Athletics Federation laid out what it sees as a, quote, bleak future for sports. The federation has suspended track and field events as part of budget cutbacks, and that's putting into question Greece's ability to compete in the London Olympics this summer. Christopher Wirth has more.
The Olympic Games started in Greece, but today the Olympic spirit may be flagging. Georgi Pamaski is a coach for Greece's national athletics team. I asked him whether his athletes were ready for the summer games. He says maybe.
Maybe.
Greece has been on the verge of bankruptcy for the last 3 years. The Greek Athletics Federation has seen its budget cut by 25%. The organization is struggling to pay coaches and athletes. And Pomaski says his training facility can't even afford hot water.
This moment, the federation don't have money. Don't have money from electricity. It's very cold.
Budget problems may be most acute in Greece, but they're also hurting other European countries ahead of the Olympics. Paul Downward is a sports economist at Loughborough University in England.
What you will see probably in smaller countries is a honing down of their teams.
It's the age of austerity in Europe, and Downward says he expects London's summer games to seem very austere when compared with the Beijing Olympics just 4 years ago. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
So, Jeremy, as reporters, we all have dream assignments. What would your dream assignment be?
You know, anything that involves the word Hawaii would be good. I think
Pacific Beach?
The South Pacific would be great. I must say, though, that on the flip side of that, I would love to go, like, cover – to be one of those people covering a hurricane, like, down in Florida, like, right on the beach when it's just smashing against the – anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know, that's kind of weird.
Right in the thick of it.
What about you?
You know, South Pacific Beat actually sounds pretty great, or like, I don't know, some kind of exploration reporting, going to the jungle. I don't know.
No, that sounds good, too. Well, right now, though, Stacey, we have somebody with us who got to do the absolute most amazing assignment ever.
Really?
A writer for the New York Times, Kevin Roos. He got to be a billionaire for a day, and he's here to talk with us now for our Midday Extra. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, guys.
So tell us what you got to do as a billionaire.
Well, I wanted to explore this idea that we're
at once in America very angry at billionaires. We feel like they've caused our economic problems, and we feel like they're to blame for some of the ills of the past few years. We're also totally obsessed with them on a personal level. I cover Wall Street, and so I'm around some of these guys. I'm not rich, but I've seen a lot of it. So I wanted to go inside the billionaire economy for a day. So I did everything. I got picked up from my apartment in a chauffeured Rolls Royce. I went on a private jet with a hedge fund manager, went to a private gym where you pay $13,000 a year and you have two wow. on-one personal training. There's one trainer who's leading the workout and one trainer who's just sort of like there to help. He's like taking notes and he runs over and gets the dumbbells and puts them on your lap so you don't even have to, get up from your bench. I mean, it's really fantastic. So it was. I'm not getting too much sympathy in the newsroom these days.
So what was it like to be a billionaire for a day? What struck you?
Well, what struck me, I actually got to speak with a billionaire while I was on his private jet, and I asked him, what it's like to do this, not just for a day, but full time. And he said basically, that it just makes things easier. Mm. And it's true. I mean, transportation is much easier when you don't have to take the subway. You just, your driver pulls up to wherever you are. You've got your private jet. You don't have to go through security. I mean, it is much easier to get around as a billionaire. But other than that, I would say the gains are not as big as people say they are. And the billionaires themselves don't seem any happier than, just normal middle-class people that I hang out with.
What were the downfalls? Did the billionaires you were hanging out with say anything that was a negative for them?
Well, one thing that I've heard a lot and that this billionaire told me during the day was that you worry about your kids. You worry, most billionaires are self-made. They didn't come from dynasties. And yet their kids are growing up with all this privilege. So how do you keep them humble? How do you make sure they're good people despite, having access to basically anything they want their entire life?
Did this exercise make you rethink at all some of the income inequality questions that we've been talking about a lot in this country?
It did. I mean, I think one of the takeaways is that probably if you taxed billionaires at, 75 or 80%, I don't think their lifestyle would actually change that much. It's really hard to spend $1 billion, despite how these guys try. And I don't even know that they would necessarily even notice if you taxed them 80%, unless, their accountant told them. So I think, the question of whether you start at $1 million a year with higher taxes or whether you start at $1 billion a year, that all has to be hammered out. And I think there are good cases on either side of that debate. But I found it very hard to believe that these guys are taxed enough just based on, the observations of how much money there is to throw around on just the everyday activities.
Well, Kevin, the big question then I have for you is how are you going to top this assignment? What's next?
Well, I had one reader suggest that I spend a day, living as a living on a park bench or something, begging for money just to see the other side. So maybe I'll do that one and right my karmic imbalance here.
Good. Well, we'd love to talk to you after you do that. Kevin Roos of The New York Times, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks, guys.
So, Jeremy, I have great news.
Oh, really?
You.
Yeah. Do I get to go be a billionaire for a day?
Well, not that great, but okay. It's pretty good. The next time you go in to ask our boss for more vacation, I have the perfect line. You can tell him that your life depends on it.
Really?
Yes, it's true,
and
too.
And that'll work?
Well, it should. I hope it does. According to data compiled by Confused.com, they aggregated a whole bunch of different studies. People who take holidays are happier, more productive at work, feel better about their jobs, and, this is the kicker, are 20% less likely to die at an earlier age.
Wow.
Yeah. I guess vacation relieves stress and lowers blood pressure. And
it's time for a vacation, I'd say.
I think we should. I know. Let's book our appointments right now.
Absolutely. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.